Welcome to the VIP Jaswal Report. Apologies in advance if I'm sounding a little muffled today as I have a bout of the flu, but nevertheless, as the old saying goes, the show must go on. Here's a question for you. What type of music do you associate God with? Because for me, I think of a gospel choir, or maybe even some type of meditational instrument like a harp or violin. You know what I mean. Well, when my next guest sent me his music CD, I poured myself a glass of wine, took out a big cigar, sat in my favorite leather chair, preparing myself for a calm and inspirational session of beautifully divine music. But the moment I pressed play, something strange happened. My eardrums started to shake. It felt like Miley Cyrus was twerking on my face. The hairs on my chest started to separate. I thought Moses had decided to make an appearance. And my stomach started to tremble. I thought I was going to have an uncontrollable bowel movement, only because I was expecting to hear something smooth and soft. But I got caught off guard. The music was heavy metal with the words of Jesus intertwined. Call me old-fashioned, but I wasn't expecting to hear this style of music as a form of religious expression. Maybe I just have a delicate disposition. Nevertheless, it sounded good and was like a breath of fresh air. My perception of heavy metal has always been that of aggression and extreme masculinity, but that, I guess, is just my ignorance. Well, let's put that perception to rest, because our guest today is the Christian rock and heavy metal singer Michael Sweet, who's the lead singer from the band Striper. He sold over 8 million records worldwide, been nominated for a Grammy, and won a Dove Award. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Zip, thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm good, sir, and how are you?
I am well, and my first thought when you think of music that best describes Christian is I think of polka.
Oh, yeah?
No, not at all.
Well, I tell you what, how's your voice doing?
My voice isn't so bad. I've been doing a lot of interviews lately, and my ears aren't doing too good. They're burning, but from the phone being held up to them for hours upon hours. But you know what? I'm doing pretty good vocally.
Those are just interviews. This is going to be an experience.
Well, I'm excited, and I'm sorry to hear that you're a little under the weather. And I'm glad the show is going on.
Well, you know the way you look, and you're, what are you, 6 foot something?
I would like to think that I'm 6'5", but I'm actually 6'1".
6'1", great. I thought I'd better show up. Well, I want to start by asking you, what was the most defining moment in your life that made you a religious Christian?
The most defining moment in my life was when I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I, through the lead of my family, sat in front of a television and accepted Christ into my heart through Jimmy Swaggart Ministries.
Out of all people.
Out of all people, yes. And we were drawn to him because of his music. He played piano. He's actually the cousin of Jerry Lee Lewis and Mickey Gilley. Not too many people know that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were drawn to him by his music because he kind of sounded like Elvis.
Right.
And my father's a big Elvis fan, and therefore I'm a big Elvis fan. And we were instantly brought in by the sound of his voice and his piano playing and then his preaching. And it really opened our hearts and touched us in a way to obviously sit there as a family and ask God into our hearts. And then we got into a church soon after.
Now, you've taken that belief and made it your life through your profession.
Yes, eventually. Not at that moment.
Right.
But yes, down the road. I fell away from church at the age of 13 and started playing clubs in Hollywood. And I eventually, at the age of 20, came back full circle and rededicated my life to God. And I've been doing it ever since. I'm 22 years old now.
So now your style of music, I mean, what's the contemporary name for it? Heavy metal?
Glam metal?
What is it?
I would say, yeah, we're a hard rock / heavy metal band, yes.
Now, for someone who's been a fan of Elvis, to go, I thought you would have followed along that line in terms of style of music. What made you choose heavy rock?
I'm a fan of Elvis, of course, his music, as is most of the world, but I'm more so a fan of Elvis for his originality and to boldly take a stand for that. and be different. And, you know, that was certainly something that helped shape Stryper and who we are, you know, because I look at us as a band that's taken a stand for something different and gone against the grain and, you know, the tide, so to speak. And, you know, we wouldn't have it any other way. I mean, it's something we've been doing for 30 years and still happen to explain ourselves and, you know, share with people why we do what we do and how, where, when, and all that good stuff. So it's interesting.
Well, what's the message in your lyrics?
The message is one message, obviously presented in a different way from lyric to lyric, but that message, it always comes back to God's love, God's grace, God's mercy. And that's it. And through all the three things that I just mentioned, his salvation. And that's what we're all about lyrically.
Well, here's another question I have that's been playing in my mind. Obviously, you're religious, you're a Christian. You could have kept that faith to yourself and carried on your career as a heavy metal rock star and possibly have made more money without compromising any of your values.
And I would even go a bit further and take out the word possibly. I would change that to probably. I think we would have made more money. And we were on that path. We grew up on the streets of L.A., Sunset Boulevard, playing the Whiskey, Gazaris, the Troubadour, with Motley Crue, with Rat, with many bands that went on to achieve, you know, 2, 3, 4 times the success that we've achieved in terms of numbers. And, yeah, if we hadn't become a Christian band, I think we would have been more popular. But, you know, God's not necessarily popular. And we, at the end of my life, my legacy, which there is a song about on the new album called Legacy, it talks about just that, and that is our legacies aren't what we collect throughout our lives, how many cars we have, how many homes, how many clothes, or money in the bank, but it's about the lives that you touch and affect throughout your life. At least that's my opinion. And I would much rather choose that than popularity. You know, so I wouldn't go back and change a thing. I don't regret a thing.
Well, it must be more of a challenge because you write your own songs, right?
Yes, I write the majority of the material and have from the very beginning, and it is a little bit of a challenge. I mean,
well, look at it this way. If you were just a regular rock band, there are so many topics you could cover. Sex, mm-hmm. politics, crime, religion, whatever. But if you're a Christian rock band, it really has to be about Christ and the Bible.
And it's interesting because not only through our own convictions and our own beliefs, but also on the flip side of that coin, we're stereotyped and we hear... I remember making a solo album in 1994 and hearing from people literally face to face, hey, man, you didn't say Jesus enough in that song. And I just thought, wow, really? Is God that small? Are we going to limit him that much that all we have to sing about is him and mention the name Jesus 10 times in every song because you're a Christian band? That's not what it's about. It's not about your words or how many times you say Jesus. It's about your life. It's about, do you exemplify Jesus in everything you do? Do you honor Jesus in everything that you do? Do people see Jesus in you? Not hear it, but see it.
So
that's the question.
Walk me through how you go about composing the song, the words, the source of inspiration, the tune you're supposed to add to the song, the melodies, the instruments. Just walk me through it.
Well, even though I'm a complete 1,000,000% sinner, I sin on a daily basis.
You and me both.
Never claim to be perfect, never will. I always come back to, through all my sinful ways, I always come back to recognizing and acknowledging God and understanding that he is almighty and he has the answers, all of them. and this is what I believe. So through that, at the end of every day, understanding that and coming to grips with that, it inspires me to write lyrics that uplift and inspire people and direct them to God. I have an iPhone I carry around with me, and I'm constantly humming ideas into it. The music always comes first. I have a melody in my head 24/7. I drive everyone around me crazy because I'm always humming a song in my head and out loud. And then I go down to my studio with those ideas on my phone, and I create songs and arrange songs from those, you know, la la la, you know, ideas on my iPhone.
So you start with the tune first.
Yes.
And then you find words to go with it.
That's right. That's correct.
And is that normal?
I don't know that there is a normal. I mean, everyone does it different. I know Elton John and Bernie, I believe it's Bernie Taupin who writes the lyrics. They do it, he gets the lyrics first, and then he writes the music around the lyrics.
Mm.
So, you know, that's the way they do it. And there are people that do it like myself who get the music first and then write the lyrics around the music. So it just depends. It depends on what comes naturally and what comes first. And for me, it's music.
Well, how do you get to this higher level of creativity? Do you maybe have a smoke of a joint? have an extra glass of wine?
Well, certainly, I wouldn't say a smoke of a joint. I used to smoke pot when I was younger. Often, and I gave that up years ago because I didn't want to harm my voice. You know, I always thought, gosh, this can't be good for my vocal cords. So I stopped. But yeah,
you can do it secondary.
I'm sorry?
You can do secondary smoking.
Well,
get your friend to smoke it, and then you just sort of stand next to it.
I've done that too. But, you know, absolutely, the glass of wine. I'll have a glass of wine to relax. Sometimes I'll have a glass of wine before I sing a vocal in the studio.
I was doing that when I was trying to listen to your song, and I was expecting something smooth and soft.
Yes.
Totally rattled my cage. Good thing I wasn't wearing my dentures.
Well, you know, as people are gasping hearing Michael Sweet say he has a glass of wine with certain songs when he records them, I mean, it's all about...
Yeah, but you're not a Muslim.
Getting in the spirit and the mood and relaxing, and sometimes I'll have a cup of coffee, you know, if it's a real fast-paced song.
Do you find people are confusing you in the role of a pastor at times? Because you're singing about God, so you must be doing or you should be doing everything in a divine manner.
I do.
Is that an expectation?
I do. I mean, that definitely happens. Many people think we're ordained and we're true pastors. We are not ordained. I do consider myself to a degree a pastor in the sense that we are leading people. You know, we are pastoring people towards God, you know, and His message.
Are you leading people or are you just encouraging people to stay with the faith?
Well, I think... Maybe even not, you know.
You might be leading them to buy your album.
I think maybe not always by choice, but I think sometimes we're encouraging them and inspiring them, but we're also leading them. We are, because sometimes there are people out there that want to be led, and they don't know any other way, and they come to us for all the answers. And they'll sit down and say, what do we do with this? How do we do this? How do we do that? So in that sense, yes, we are leading them. But, I mean, we also point out very clearly and very quickly that don't look to us. We're nothing. We're going to fail you. We're going to let you down. Look to God, because He won't.
Well, taking that one step forward, because people then start to have this sense of idol worship or, you know, do pastors sometimes feel threatened by you? What's been the reaction to your style of music from the church? Because it's a very radical style.
It's a mix to the extreme. And and that is, we have the pastor such as Jimmy Swaggart, who we got saved through and found God through, who literally not long after that, when we became Striper and I was 21, 22, 23 years old, he was holding up our albums on television saying, these men are phonies, they're fakes, they're of the devil. okay? Mm-hmm. So I believe he was intimidated by not only us, but rock and roll. He grew up, his story is that he wanted to play rock and roll. And then he wound up going to church and becoming a pastor. And I think he was so passionately against rock and roll because he so passionately wanted it, you know? So it was his own conviction. Then the flip side of that are the pastors that come to us who support us and thank us because they're pastors because of Stryper, leading mega churches. I mean, we hear that and meet pastors all the time, and that's mind-blowing. That raises the hairs on my arm.
So you get two extremes.
Yes.
Because I find that the pastors who are threatened by you, it seems to be style over substance. They don't like the style.
Exactly.
But they're not really getting into the lyrics and the message that you're trying to convey. Do you ever get to meet these guys and say, look, we're not what you perceive us to be?
We have. Over the years, we've met many who don't get us. They don't want to get us. Their minds are completely closed in terms of not just Stryper, but most Christian rock.
Right.
I mean, that the mentality is, if you're a Christian, it's better now than it was, you know, 30 years ago when we first started. But the mentality is still, to a degree, if you're a Christian, you can't listen to rock and roll and you can't be in a rock band because that's of the devil.
And what other genres of music would be considered the same acts of the devil? Because it just can't be you guys. Would it be like hip-hop, rap?
Possibly. I mean, I've heard so many people over and over again say it's within the beat and it's within the minor chords, which is just ludicrous.
Well, you know, if I had to guess what music Jesus listens to, it would probably be heavy metal. I mean, the beard, the long flowing hair, you know, the entourage.
And you've
got a similar thing going on, too.
I would agree with you. I think if Jesus were here today among us in the flesh, absolutely, he'd be listening to heavy metal. Of course.
Now tell me, in your 30 years of experience, you've been on stage. Has your music changed lives? Do you have a story you could share with us?
Our music has changed many lives. Mm-hmm. I have seen so much over the 30-year history of the band. I have literally seen, I remember getting off a bus late at night to get some food in a city, a big major city, and we get off of the bus and there's a gentleman outside the bus, outside the establishment where we're going to get food, and he was a drug addict, just getting ready to shoot up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he was obviously homeless and just... it was so sad to see. And something was put upon our hearts to not just walk past him and ignore him, but to sit there and talk to him and put our arms around him and try to help him through, you know, that moment and that time in his life.
Right.
And we did, and we prayed for him. And I watched this guy take all this stuff out of his pockets, drugs like I've never seen before in my life, and throw him in a trash can. And I've seen that, which is mind-blowing. I've seen people who were suicidal that we prayed for who are alive today and thriving and full of life.
Any parents ever come to you and say, you know what, thanks to your music, our children have found God?
Yes, many. Many parents have come to us, and many parents have come to us and said, because of your music, our child found God before he passed. I mean, we've had parents come and thank us for what we did in their child's life who is now gone. Really touching stories over the years. And those are the moments that all of a sudden, in an instant, it's not about rock and roll, because it never has been for us. Those are the moments that justify and solidify why we do what we do, and that is to inspire people and lead them to the light being God. And that's what we do.
Now, you took a sabbatical of sorts from 1992, right?
I did. I left.
Why did you stop? Oh, why did you leave?
We went through a period, I always call the Against the Law period. That was the name of our album that we released in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
We started making that in 90, and in 92 I left. And during that period, we were hypocrites. We were We were living the lives of hypocrites. We were phonies. We were fakes. We were everything Jimmy Swaggart was saying we were.
Right.
Because we would go on stage and tell people, you don't need to drink, you don't need alcohol, and then get off the stage, go to the bar, and not just have a glass of wine, but get drunk with them. And then have women on the bus and sitting there with our arms around women, getting more drunk. And it was just not representing or exemplifying Christ and all that we stood for. And two marriages wound up in divorce. Mine almost did. It did not, thank God, by the grace of God. But it almost destroyed our lives. We wound up filing bankruptcy as individual partners. We were part of a partnership.
Right.
We couldn't decide who the president was going to be because of our pride. And we never incorporated. And we wound up going bankrupt because we were $2.5 million in debt. But it all led and came from that period. And I came to a moment in my life, crossroads in my life, where I woke up one morning and said, I don't want this anymore because I can't look at myself in the mirror. So I left.
But then one of the beauties of Christianity is the ability to forgive.
Yes.
But you decided to rather than mend your ways, just leave the whole situation.
I couldn't handle mending the ways at that time. I was so, in the muck and in such a deep hole that I had not climbed out of yet. I wasn't in a position to mend the ways or, it wasn't about forgiving. It was more so about just trying to find something new to take me down a different path. And I guess to a degree, escaping.
In a way, it's so similar, isn't it? A regular rock band and then a Christian rock band, and you have the same challenges and the temptations and the corruption that goes on.
Yeah, and here's a very important part, and something that I want to encourage anyone listening that may be in a Christian rock band or soon to be. You have to be accountable. You have to surround yourself and yourselves with people that are going to strengthen you. Not people that are going to, lead you to temptation and say, hey, drink from this water. You got to run from temptation, not to
it. And you have that now? You have that circle of strength around you?
We do. We do, absolutely. And I can honestly sit here and say so with such joy that we have not gone down that path since. Since the Against the Law period, we disbanded, reformed in 03, and have been going since on a path that is, that is righteous, that is not hypocritical, that is real and true, and we've stayed on the straight and narrow, and that's not by our doing, but by the strength of the Lord, and I'm just so blessed to be able to sit here and tell you that. It's amazing.
Well, being real and being true also means being imperfect.
Yes.
So what are the sort of mistakes that you've made that you could share with us? And give me something spicy.
Well, the mistakes that I've made throughout my life, I mean, my gosh. I mean, here I am, my wife at the time, Kyle, is pregnant with my daughter, Alina, and I'm out getting drunk every night, and I have a different woman on my around my arm every night. Mm. Obviously, that was... those were major mistakes repeated night after night. It never led, thank God. I talk about this in my book. I have a book coming out soon, autobiography. But it never led to the full deed.
Sure.
But it may as well have, because, adultery is adultery.
So you did a Bill Clinton then?
Well, yeah. Well, I didn't.
No, it worked around the words. I mean, yeah, but I agree with you. You know what? Sometimes in society, I think embracing a woman and being intimate with a woman, it can be the same thing.
It is. And biblically, if you believe in the Bible and call yourself a Christian, it is the same thing. If you have the thought in your mind,
exactly.
You committed adultery.
Exactly.
So, yes, I was committing adultery every night.
So does my wife, because she keeps dreaming of George Clooney. So. Now, you have fame through Christ. And you surround yourself in this religious world. Your fans, I guess it's safe for me to say, are to a certain extent religious. You operate in religious venues as well. And you've seen a lot of pastors, you've been to a lot of churches, mega churches, you've been abroad. What's disturbed you in this whole business of religion?
The thing that disturbs me about religion, and we do have many religious fans, but we also have people who are not religious, who are atheists.
Right.
Who love the band. Satanists.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Did you say Satanists?
We were part of a show on VH1 not long ago, probably about 11, 12 years ago, so I guess fairly long ago. Mm. And it was a show where they would, I don't remember the name of it, but they would basically play three or four videos for one group of people, for, say, the kids, and then the three or four videos for the parents. And they would get the different views. Well, we were on a show once with Madonna, a Marilyn Manson video, a Stryper video, and they played all those videos with religious content to a group of religious leaders. None of them knew who we were, which is really funny and odd. Mm. Then they played it for a group of Satanists. All the Satanists in unison said, who is this? And in unison, they all said, Stryper. They all knew who we were, and they were fans of the band.
But what is a Satanist?
A Satanist is a person who believes that Satan is God, and they worship Satan.
So why would they be your fans?
You'd have to ask them that. I would assume because they like the music.
That's what I was thinking. Maybe they like the tone, they like the look.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, they're deaf to the words.
Sure, and there's a lot. You look at the reverse side of that coin, there's a lot of Christian people that listen to black metal and satanic metal because they like the sound.
Right. I get you.
Yeah.
So now I'm, you know what, you've seen the temptations and the bad and the good of being a rock star. Tell us about a few things that you've seen in the world of religion in terms of meeting with pastors, the corrupt side of the business.
Well, I've seen a lot. I've expressed, you know, I'm not a person here to cast, you know, stones at anyone or put blame on anyone because I've been there and done that and all of the above. But I am here to say that, yeah, I've seen that. I've walked into a church thinking one thing and walked out thinking another. You know, when you go into a church that represents and their motto and their goal in life is to feed the hungry.
Right.
And then you go there and you see that the pastor has a Bentley, a Porsche, a Mercedes, and, you know, a boat in his garage and four homes. And we're going out and dropping $5,000 on a meal with, you know, 20 people or what have you. You're just kind of thinking, wow, okay. It doesn't necessarily add up. And you got to be really careful of that if you're going to claim to be a Christian, because my belief is that someday we're all going to be judged for our deeds and our actions and how we handled, you know, the things that God loaned to us.
Do you have any pastors that are on your blacklist that you would refuse to perform for their congregation simply because you know, or you have a feeling that they are corrupt or they don't have ethics?
Oh, gosh. Off the top of my head, no. In the past, yeah. I mean, I was kind of – we were put on Jimmy Swaggart's blacklist, and then therefore through that, he kind of went on our blacklist because we just thought, wow, you know, here's this guy that we – you know, that brought us to God, and he's excommunicated us and telling people – they used to come to our shows with bullhorns and tell people not to go in. And eventually that led to anger and rebellion in us, and we kind of put him on the blacklist and didn't want to have anything to do with him, you know, or mention his name or anything. In terms of other pastors, you know, we were actually friends with Jim Baker. I haven't spoken to him in years, and then the whole scandal with Jim happened, and you know, that was a real tragic, sad situation. I actually felt really bad for Jim because he was a sweet man, what little I knew about him. But you know what? There are so many pastors, not really that I can just say, oh yeah, this pastor, that name, but so many I've come in contact with over the years that you just get a sense that it's not real. And it's not my place to point them out and say, hey, world, this guy's not real. It's really God's place. And you know what? He's going to. I mean, it's going to be exposed.
No, but in a sense, you have a message, a pure message. It's in your lyrics, in your song. It's just disguised as, in an aggressive and a masculine format, as I had said earlier, that's heavy metal for you. But your message is sincere and pure, right?
It is.
You want to go to a pastor that you have a feeling that things are not quite right?
Absolutely.
Because that could end up damaging your reputation.
What I would choose to do, if I went to a church and after 2 or 3 or 4 months or a year of going and feeling like, wow, this is great, and then discovering that it's not so good, that it's there's a lot of bad stuff going on or he's having an affair or whatever, I couldn't be gone quick enough.
Right.
I wouldn't be one to say expose him or the church and try to bring them down. That's not my style. But I would get out of there. I couldn't get out of there quick enough. Happened many times.
Oh, wow.
In my life. I've left many churches because of that stuff. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I watch them on TV.
Yeah.
And I sometimes can't believe you get this gut instinct that not everything is not what it seems.
And exactly, you don't.
And you just look at the audience and say, "Wow, you know something's not right with the guy."
Yeah.
You see the audience, and there is a moment of disgust. There's a moment of jealousy. That how could so many people be so stupid? Is it just me who's seeing there's something not right here?
I get angry. It makes me angry because exactly, and so many times, and some of them have been brought down and exposed by, national TV and networks and, these guys that take people's money who are retired and they give them all their retirement money and they have nothing left. And you see what they're doing and throwing their letters of, that they're sick and dying in the trash and taking the check and cashing it and driving 2 Bentleys. And you're just thinking, wow.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. But anyway, that's that. Where in your life have you needed God the most?
Oh, gosh, I still not only have needed him, but I still need him the most in my life. I have a lot of issues, a lot of weaknesses.
What's been your darkest moment?
Well, my darkest moment, my wife, Kyle, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And we devoted our lives to God and to Christ. And she truly, helped many people and went out of her way to really live a life that was devoted to God. And then she's diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and suffering. Our children were young. And I was her caretaker, and I basically watched my wife die. And there was a time during that period, that 2-year period from 07 to 09, that I felt that it was a joke. I felt that God was a joke, that he wasn't there. And I even questioned if there was a God. And because it felt like during that dark, the darkest period of my life, it really felt briefly that, he wasn't there. I was calling him like, where are you, God? My wife was praying to be healed and to not feel so sick. And I mean, she's throwing up, 50 times a day and, she's constipated and then diarrhea and having her lungs tapped and, Coumadin because she had issues with blood, just all these things going on. It was like a chain reaction that we couldn't get a grip on. I was just thinking, this is torturous. God, where are you?
So who did you look to for support?
I looked to my friends. Yeah. I called my friends, my pastors. I have many pastor friends that I contacted and, cried my eyes out every phone conversation. And, I felt like I got immense support, incredible support. Unfortunately, tragically, through that, after my wife passed, it was really odd because the minute she took her last breath, I felt instantly like as if you turned on a light. I felt peace. And as weird as that may sound...
No, it doesn't, because it was an end to her suffering, I take it.
It was an end to her suffering, and I felt peace. And I instantly, because of that, was determined to move forward. And I felt like, okay, I know where she is. She's not suffering anymore, and I'm going to see her again. And you know what? I'm moving forward. And I did. And relatively soon after that, I met somebody who is now my wife, who's a godsend and an angel and the most remarkable woman. Her name's Lisa Champagne. And through that time, I lost a lot of friends.
But during the time your wife had cancer, during that time while you were looking after her, did both of you heal all past wounds?
Did both, during the time she had cancer, did we heal, did our wounds heal in mm-hmm. terms of wounds from her being sick?
No. From all your, like you said, you know, when you were touring, it placed a stress on your relationship. You almost divorced, but you didn't. So all the memories of the, for lack of a better word, sins of the past that either of you or both of you had done.
Absolutely.
Was it
Absolutely.
A healing time for the relationship?
Yes, and even prior to that, there was a lot of healing time. When I left the band in 92, mm-hmm. up until the time that she got sick in 07, February of 07, there was a lot of healing that took place. And our marriage miraculously was saved
now,
when it should not have been.
Now, you say now in your new marriage you've lost a lot of friends. Well, what's the problem with the new marriage?
Well... No problem with me, you know, and no problem in God's eyes either. Just the people that are traditional and old school that feel like you have to wait a certain length of time and, you know, you can't do this and you can't do that. I met this wonderful woman soon after my wife passed and we started dating, almost 8 weeks, which isn't long.
Right.
And, of course, I'll be the first to admit that. And it would probably shock me to a degree if one of my friend's wife or one of my friend's husband passed and they were dating relatively soon afterwards. But as a friend, I would eventually come to the understanding like, okay, wait, this is real. And I think that our relationship has proven it's real because we've been married. We're going on our fourth year of marriage. And I tell you, she's such an incredible person. But I lost some of my closest friends who literally said to me point blank, you're wrong, what you're doing is wrong, and we don't support you anymore. And it was over just like that. And my relationship with a handful of people who were very close to me was gone.
Did that act as some sort of inspiration for your music as well?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got a few songs. I've got a song on my solo album that's coming out called I'm Not Your Suicide.
Right. Well, I think what your friends, when they left you, and I hope they're listening, I don't think they actually understood that when you were taking care of your wife, you knew the ultimate fate of your wife.
Yes.
So you had time to adjust to it. That's why you could come out of it so much more quick.
That's right.
Whereas if someone dies suddenly, there is that shock value. You never had to go through shock. You went through a long term of pain.
And you know, it's so...
Am I right?
Yeah, Vip. It's interesting to hear you say that because it's exactly what I've been saying and have expressed many times. Mm. I grieved for 2 years.
Right.
And when my wife passed and took her last breath and I knew where she was and she wasn't suffering anymore, my grief ended.
Right.
Instantly.
Well, you know what? I always view these things in life when these sort of so-called friends terminate their relationship, life acts as a filtering process.
Yeah.
As we get older, the things around us get purer because the bad stuff goes away.
Wow, that's a great way of putting it.
It is. You know, a friend of mine was talking last weekend, and we were talking about a few of our common friends, and he said to me, his wife said to me, oh, you know, human beings are social animals, so we need to really tolerate everyone and be with everyone. I said, that's one point of view, and you're entitled to your point of view, and here's my point of view. And the fact is, I'm more black and white. I really want to surround myself with goodness, happiness, and contentment. I don't want to be with a bunch of people where there is bad blood going through everyone's veins.
Yeah.
Not just because I need to be social. No, if I need to be social, I'll get a dog. You know, it's really that simple. And again, it's just my opinion. It's not a fact. It's just a point of view. I'd rather have less, but in that less, I have more. So it's more substance than style.
And I do, and I 100% agree with you, and I do have more because I'll tell you why. I chose, obviously, my family, my children, and I chose my wife, Lisa, over the bad, as you put it. And you're right. It really was a negative force in my life. These people, this handful of people that the calls were negative, the things that were said were negative, the actions were negative. I'm just saying, this is just wrong. This is horrible. And now that negativity is, for the most part, out of my life. I'd be a liar if I said it isn't still an open wound.
Look, I'd rather leave someone who's negative or misunderstands me or does not respect me after 2 years than after 4 years.
Yes.
Because in 2 years, I have less baggage to offload than I do in four.
Right. Right.
So, you know, they can go. Because yep. Now, I can see clearly now.
Absolutely. And it's so good to hear you say that. And gosh, to echo my thoughts for the past 4 years, it's so good. That's a confirmation to me that you're absolutely right, and I'm right in how I've been thinking. And, you know, I certainly don't want to hold grudges. I'm just trying to move forward and enjoy life. I always say enjoy life to the fullest because it's here and gone. It's so short, and it is.
Now, you talked about your relationship as a husband. What about you as a father? You're a father to two kids?
I'm a father to a soon-to-be 27-year-old son, Michael Jr.,
mm-hmm.
and a soon-to-be 23-year-old daughter, Alina Ray.
Well, being a rock star, did that compromise you as the role in terms of fatherhood?
I feel that it has to a degree. I've tried to make up ground over the years, but there's been a lot of times that I've been away and a lot of things I've missed out on. And then also there's been a lot of things that I've been able to be a part of because of the time off. And when I have time off, I don't go to a 9-to-5 job.
Right.
So I guess it's kind of balanced out over the years, to be honest.
And who were you closer to, your daughter or your son?
Definitely my daughter. My daughter is, you know, someone that I've always been closer to. I mean, not to say that I love her more than my son. I love my son equally as much. He was our firstborn, and, you know, obviously I would die for my son or my daughter. But the relationship with my son is not as good as I would like it to be. I think because we're so much alike, you know, we don't know how to talk to each other. We don't know how to communicate.
Well, what message would you like to give your son when you know he's not around, but he needs to know?
Well, I'd like him to know how much I love him. And although I don't always show it, I know it. And I want him to know it. I would do anything in the world for him. And I try to show that through literally giving him things. You know, if he needs money, giving him money. If he needs this, giving him that. If he needs help getting a job, helping him get a job. All that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, that's not necessarily how you show true love. Sometimes it has to be tough love. And I've backed away from that, from, you know, I guess, for lack of a better term, spoiling him and giving him all the...
But he's 27, right?
He's going to be 27.
Okay, so he's a big boy now. What does... Maybe he's confused about how to show his love to you. What would you like to see him do or say to you that would help start building the bridge?
Just that, say to me. Because what happens often with Mike, and with me too, we both do this, is we don't say it.
You know, sometimes saying it is awkward. You got to get to a certain level. It's like dating. You know, women don't say, I love you, very quickly.
Yes.
The men are ready because hopefully they'll score. So it's three words. You know, and I can get over that. I mean, I don't suffer from any I'm morally very thin. but like for the guys, you know, to say to their father, and it might sound pansy-ish, it might sound weak. So instead of limiting it to those words, what could, say, your son do to you that would personify those three words?
Just, you know, confide in me. Confide in me. Talk to me. Open up to me. You know, my son.
Does he think you give an opinion?
Yeah. And I probably would, and that's something I need to change. Sometimes I need to just listen, be a good listener. You know, not
always.
Do you guys hang
out once a week?
Oh no, we don't, because he lives about 2 hours away. We used to. What happened was, when, and this is my perspective and my opinion, but when his mom got sick, he kind of ran away, and I don't necessarily blame him. You know, it was very difficult to face, but he kind of ran away, moved out, and didn't want to be around much. And I had to literally beg him. I was on tour with Boston in 08. I had to beg him to come back home and spend time with his mom without saying, Mike, this is going to be your final days with her.
Right. Well, those are very common issues with a lot of families.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to run away from my wife, but I have to come back. She holds the credit cards.
And just because I'm a Christian doesn't mean I have all the answers and I've got it all together. You know, I don't. And all the more reason why I need Christ.
But you know, one thing, I've interviewed a lot of people, pastors, a lot of Christians, so a few Muslims. Christianity does not claim to have the answers.
Hmm.
It basically is a test of your faith. And that's really it.
Yeah.
If you're looking for answers, why do school massacres happen? Why do earthquakes happen? Why is there globe? It doesn't have those answers. It doesn't claim to.
Right.
And you shouldn't even bother looking for those. It doesn't exist.
Well, I tell you, my faith, although it's been shaken over the years, to even to the point of doubting God,
right?
It's deeper now than it's ever been.
All right, well, that's the Oprah phase of the show. Let's move on. Okay, I want to know. Tell us one thing no one knows about you.
One thing nobody knows about me. Oh,
and for
God.
Christ's sake, make it spicy. And I'm not using the God's name in vain.
Spicy. I have to be very careful about what I eat. Because I have a situation.
Oh, I feel a bowel movement coming on. No, that's not.
Yeah.
No, come on. What, you like lingerie? What is it? Tell me.
Oh God.
Tell me something. Tell me something unholy.
I like my wife to buy and wear lingerie. Of course.
Okay, that's not spicy. Okay.
Not too many people know about me. Honestly, Vip, I'm pretty boring. There's not a lot of spice in my. In the closets of my mind and heart. I'm OCD, I'm ADHD, terribly. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that unfortunately makes me a nasty person sometimes. A nasty person to be around, a very difficult person to be around.
You mean you get irritable?
I do.
Okay. Are you violent?
No, not okay. Violent. But I get irritable and I can rant and rave and go on and on and on and on.
You don't
and
act
on.
Like that cartoon character Captain Caveman then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Banging the woman and, you know, taking her into the cave. And
and I can drive those around me who love me, who are close to me, absolutely insane.
Right.
Absolutely. I don't know if that's spicy enough for you, but... if you want spice, I love spicy food. I love it.
What's your favorite food in
oh
terms
my
of
God.
Spicy
Probably
food?
My favorite. I would have to say my favorite food is authentic Mexican food. Second to that, or close running, would be, believe it or not, sushi, Japanese.
Okay, that's not spicy. That's a bunch of rice with the meat.
No, but I always get it.
What do you do, add avocado and think you're being exotic?
I always ask them to bring up.
And Mexican is not like spicy.
I know.
That's like next door.
Well, Indian, I like Indian food to a degree, too.
Oh, okay, that's now we're talking. What about Filipino food?
You know what? My uncle, Uncle Pete, was Filipino.
Oh.
And we used to go over to his house, and he married my aunt. And
nice of him.
We used to go over there, and he would cook, and he was amazing, and I love Filipino
food. Did you ever have balut?
Yes.
That has to be the grossest, most cruel thing ever. That's like when you open the egg, and there is a chick that hasn't fully formed with feathers, and you have to eat it.
Oh, Lord.
It's finger-licking good, buddy, finger-licking good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that. But now, No More Hell to Pay, your new album. Out tomorrow?
Out, it depends on when this show airs. It's out
1st of November 2013.
5th of November.
No More Hell to Pay. Do those words mean anything? That means you've paid your dues. No more hell to pay.
What those words mean to me and what I'm trying to suggest and get across is when you believe in God and when you put your faith in God and you have a close personal relationship with God, there is no more hell to pay in the sense that you can give it to God. Yeah, you're still going to have to go through trial and error. Yes, you're still going to be tempted. Yes, you're still going to go through all the things that life has to offer. But you have someone to fall on, someone that can carry you, pick you up and carry you when you can't walk anymore.
Right.
And that's what I mean by the song. There's no more hell to pay when you believe in God.
And what's your favorite song in the album?
Oh, gosh, my favorite song. Lately, I've been really liking the up-tempo high energy songs such as Legacy, I was referring to earlier, a song called Te Amo, which is dedicated to our Latin American fans, and we have many Latin American fans. It's not in Spanish, but the title is, which means I love you.
Obviously. Any particular lyrics in those songs that sort of come to you and mean a lot?
Well, I mean, the song Legacy, which is actually streaming online. Mm. It speaks of, that lyric speaks of, again, so often people think that their legacy is everything that they leave in their will, everything that they leave behind to their kids and their family.
Right.
And I think the contrary. I think the exact opposite. I think your legacy is what you leave in terms of, did you inspire people? Did you change people in a good way? Did you light up the dark room? Did you encourage those around you? You know, to me, that's what you leave, and that's what matters in the end.
So a qualitative legacy as opposed to a quantitative legacy.
Well, I mean, you know, for example, the lyric is, we've built an empire.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, we can't take with us. We walk the high wire. We cross the boundaries, and that's our rush. But when we step beyond the other side, there will be nothing to hide. What's our legacy? Will we be humble far beyond our pride, or are we in for a rough ride? What's our legacy?
Nice.
You know, and that's the gist of it, in my opinion. You know, don't put all your eggs in one basket in terms of trying to collect as much as you can on earth in terms of material things. You know, change people's lives.
Now, where can we get the album?
You can get the album at Amazon.com. You can get it at iTunes. You can get it at Walmart, Kmart, Best Buy, hopefully anywhere that you can purchase music, either physically or digitally.
This album cover you have, it's a man sort of stretching out, right?
What it's supposed to represent
and
signify is being set free from hell and ascending towards the heavens, looking to God and ascending towards the heavens, because only God can set you free from hell. And therefore, because he's paid the price through Christ on the cross, there is no more hell to pay. So you're being set free from the chains that bind you to hell.
Yeah, it's a beautiful cover. Now, we got a few minutes left. We got some questions from your fans.
Yes.
So very quickly, how did the name Striper come about, and all the yellow outfits represent what again? That was by Gio Ewan.
The name Stryper came about, just the real short of it, is the label hated the name that we had prior, and that was Rox Regime.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tongue twister. So I didn't blame them. I hated that name too. And they asked if we would change it, and we did, and everything was already striped
right
then. And we, after a few weeks, decided to go with Stryper. We changed the I to a Y, came up with the acronym Salvation Through Redemption Yielding Peace.
Mr. Sweet, you are a cunning linguist, if I may say so. That was good.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. That was a good one. Now, Gerardo Santiago says, I want to know in what position will No More Hell to Pay you think will hit the Billboard chart?
Oh, gosh. Well, I would like
give a number and we'll move on.
Realistic, top 20.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Iridium Rare says, do you think Stryper will help a resurgence of metal in America?
That would be a beautiful thing. I mean, we've kind of had so many letdowns over the year. I don't want to say we're Debbie Downers and always going, wah, wah, you know. But we're praying for that. That would be amazing.
Ken Dale says, how hard has it been to be criticized for everything you say or do for 30 years, and how do you handle it?
Very difficult. Sometimes we want to slap the person criticizing us, or better yet, punch them.
Works for me.
But you know what? It's become like water on a duck's back, where it just kind of rolls off, and we move forward because we stay focused, hyper focused. We stay hyper focused on our journey and on our goal, and we know exactly where that's taking us, and we just continue on that path.
Great. What does the future hold for you and the band?
I would like to think that it holds the best yet. The best is yet to come.
Now, you said a book is coming out?
Book is coming. Autobiography, Michael Sweet, is called Honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And a solo record next year.
You're writing it yourself, the book, or are you getting a ghostwriter? What's the secret?
Ghostwriter who basically interviewed me for 16 hours, took my words and wrote them, and then I edited
it. And then charged you $30,000, and I know the deal.
Oh. You know the deal. Exactly.
Yeah, there you go, you know. Oh, God. Okay. Well, I hope you're going to be as explicitly frank as you were with me in the book.
Oh, yeah, I'm very
frank. If you
were
more, then there's going to be trouble. Because I didn't charge you $30,000. I didn't get $30,000.
That's why it's called Honestly. It's a brutally honest book.
Right.
But yet I didn't purposely set out to throw full bodies under the bus. You know, I didn't try to hurt people, but it's telling it like it is and what happened over the last 30 years. Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much, sir, for coming on the show. It's been great, and we've got to have you back.
Thank you, Vip. It's been a pleasure, and I think you're an amazing interviewer, and I appreciate you having me on.
Well, my mother tells me so. Thank you.
You are.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. That was Michael Sweet. For more fascinating stories, log on to foxnewsradio.com and click onto the VIP Jazzwell Report. And keep your ears open for the next airing of the report coming soon.